Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello. Before you start your podcast, my name's Greg Jenner. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the Radio 4 comedy show that takes history seriously. And I'm delighted to say we have a new series coming soon. As ever, I'm joined by top historians and fantastic comedians to talk about a wonderful array of historical subjects from all over the world. Stuff you did at school and stuff you've never even heard of. So if that sounds like fun, if you want to come and laugh while you learn, then check out You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 25th of February, these are our main stories. Leaders from the G7 group of wealthy nations have said that any country which helps Russia evade sanctions will face severe costs. Ukraine says a resolution passed by UN members on Thursday calling for Russia to withdraw should be the basis for any peace plan. And the authorities in southern Ethiopia are warning of a deepening humanitarian crisis caused by a severe drought. Also in this podcast...
I went around the whole of Germany with a lot of elephant poo, and I presented it to different elephants.
All in the name of science, of course. We find out what she discovered later. Leaders from the G7 group of wealthy nations have promised to punish any countries which help Russia evade sanctions. The announcement was made on the first anniversary of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, with Russia having new sanctions imposed. The German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, said Russia's activities would be closely monitored as more sanctions come into force.
We must keep up the pressure so that Russia returns to international law and eventually sits down at the negotiating table. Of course, this also includes economic pressure. We in the G7 are united in continuing to closely coordinate our sanctions while closing loopholes. Today, we have committed ourselves to further joint measures.
With more details, here's our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
The tone of the announcement was certainly severe. Any countries, it said, which helped Russia get round sanctions would face severe costs. What those costs would be wasn't spelled out, but the strength of the threat reflects the depth of the problem. Wide-ranging sanctions have been imposed on Russia, and new ones have just been announced, but there have been repeated reports of companies and countries buying Russian products and then selling them on with their origin hidden. Plugging that hole is the tricky task which the G7 has now effectively set for itself.
Earlier, Ukraine's allies offered more support. The US said that it would provide another $2 billion worth of weaponry. Meanwhile, Poland has delivered Ukraine its first Leopard tanks, and Sweden has joined the growing list of countries promising to send a Leopard 2 model. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held a news conference in Kyiv, and he had this message for Moscow. Respect our rights to live on our land. Get out of our territory. Stop bombing us. Stop killing civilians. And he went on to say that he was confident of victory.
I believe that each of us and a partner in our country will remain strong, remain a strong fist. And if our partners are united for our victory, because that victory will happen, and if all of us will perform our tasks, then we will have victory.
Well, on Thursday, some of those partners helped pass a resolution at the UN General Assembly calling on Russia to immediately withdraw from Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky went on to appeal to nations less forthright in their support, like China and those in parts of Latin America and Africa. Paul Adams is our diplomatic correspondent, and I asked him how well the international support for Ukraine is holding up.
Well, I think the vote at the UN General Assembly would have come as quite a relief to Ukraine's Western backers. They might have anticipated that Russia's efforts to kind of, you know, drive a wedge to persuade the Global South in particular to stay on board with Moscow's position might have paid off. In fact, that was one of the better results for Ukraine and its Western backers. 141 countries backing that resolution. That was a pretty resounding success. If you take that and you combine that with, you know, the continued provision of vital military equipment to Ukraine, we had today the Poles announcing that they had actually already delivered the first four Leopard tanks. So there is a real sense that the Western orchestrated support for Ukraine is holding up. It is still enormously challenging, but it is working.
Meanwhile, there are dozens of countries, more than 30 countries, abstained in that vote you were talking about there on Thursday. And the role of China as well, there does seem to be pressure from Beijing on Ukraine to agree to some kind of compromise. Where do you see that going? Is it going to grow, do you think?
There is obviously a sense that all eyes are on China at the moment. You know, we had earlier in the week the Americans saying that they had evidence that China was contemplating sending military equipment to Russia. If that were to happen, that would be an absolutely enormously consequential move. But what we have at the same time is this rather unclear diplomatic initiative from Beijing, a peace plan, although I don't think many others are really describing it as that. President Zelensky, interestingly, in his press conference, said that the very fact that China was talking about Ukraine was not in and of itself a bad thing. He said that if China sides with the idea of peace and fairness and does not supply weapons to Russia, then, you know, he's interested in hearing what China has to say.
And what is clear is that certainly Kyiv is not ready by any means to talk about giving up even a square kilometre of ground.
No, at the moment there is really no viable prospect of a peace process from either side. I mean, the Russians have shown no indication that they are abandoning their maximalist intentions of, you know, denazifying and demilitarizing Ukraine. Ukraine's position, if anything, has hardened over the past 12 months. There was a time, for example, when President Zelensky talked about putting the idea of Crimea on ice for sort of 10 years and so forth. You know, at the moment, the narrative from Kyiv is Russia has to get out of all sovereign Ukrainian territory.
Paul Adams. Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba has told the UN Security Council that a resolution passed on Thursday by the General Assembly should be the basis for any peace plan. The resolution, supported by an overwhelming majority of members, calls for Russia's full and immediate withdrawal from Ukraine. Addressing the Council, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres repeated the costs of the ongoing war.
Life is a living hell for the people of Ukraine. An estimated 17.6 million people, nearly 40% of the population of Ukraine, require humanitarian assistance and protection. The crisis has erased 30% of pre-war jobs. The World Food Programme estimates that nearly 40% of Ukrainians are unable to afford or access enough food. And war has sparked a displacement crisis not seen in Europe in decades.
The Council observed a moment's silence requested by Ukraine's foreign minister for those who died since the Russian invasion. That was interrupted by Moscow's envoy. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, reminded members Ukraine was the victim of Russian aggression.
Members of this Council should not fall into the false equivalency of calling on both sides to stop fighting or calling on other nations to stop supporting Ukraine in the name of peace. No member of this Council should call for peace while supporting Russia's war on Ukraine and on the UN Charter. In this war, there is an aggressor and there is a victim. Russia fights for conquest. Ukraine fights for its freedom.
Antony Blinken. As the Ukraine conflict enters its second year, Russia controls around about a fifth of Ukraine's territory in the east and south of the country. One of its most important strategic goals from the beginning has been the complete capture of eastern Ukraine, the area known as the Donbas. Now, one of Russia's key targets is the strategic town of Vugledar. The latest Russian attempt to take the town earlier this month ended in a humiliating defeat. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, reports now from Vugledar. Some people may find the following distressing.
We're making our way now towards the front line with Ukrainian troops passing by apartment block after apartment block that are completely destroyed. Some of them have had the front torn away, they're blackened, one in front has a huge hole punched through. It looks like it was hit by a missile. And this is just one destroyed town on Ukraine's very long front line.
Воздух! Воздух!
Пистенку!
Plane! Get down, Gopke!
We've just been told to duck down here now and take cover at the wall. The troops have heard something, possibly a Russian drone. The front line is about 500 metres away. They say Russian troops are trying to advance, but they're holding them back. How heavy is the fighting around the city now?
It's difficult, says the commander, whose code name is Beast. People are on their feet for 20 hours. The fighting goes on around the clock. I can't say more. It's secret.
People have gathered around now, mainly elderly people, wrapped up in winter coats, and they're queuing now to get some bread.
A jovial figure in combat gear is handing out the loaves. He's an evangelical pastor called Oleg Tikhachenko. Twice a week he brings aid and solace to the few hundred souls who remain in Vugledar without heat or light.
Pastor Oleg, you've been giving bread to the people. You've been hugging some of them, talking to them. They obviously mean a lot to you. How important is it to you to come here like this and take this risk?
We help because it's a matter of life or death, he tells me. We bring bread and water. The risk is huge, but so is the reward, saving people's lives. Among those queuing for bread, we meet Valentina, a small figure bent low over her walking stick. She's 73 and says she has nowhere else to go. We are frightened, of course, but what can we do? We live with it. You can't say, don't shoot. They have their job. We have our lives.
What was life like here before the invasion? How were things before?
It was good. The town was quiet, calm and clean. People worked. We had money. What can I say? It was a good town. But now it's a battlefield. We see a Ukrainian mortar team dart into position and target the enemy nearby. One year on, the Russians aren't winning here, but they aren't giving up either. And they still hold almost a fifth of Ukraine.
Oleg Garin reporting. As we heard earlier from the UN Security Council, millions and millions of Ukrainians have been affected by the war. So what was it like when, in the early morning of February the 24th last year, Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine? Well, people woke up to the sounds of rockets and helicopters overhead, troops on the streets, and panic throughout the country. Many people rushed to leave. These women recalled that morning and what it was like for them and their families.
We woke up in the morning and we were shocked because nobody believed that something can be like a war in 21st century in Europe. We saw helicopters and planes of Russians. The kids were really scared.
We woke up on February the 24th at 5 in the morning to explosions, and it was it. And I called my father, he's a military man too, and he told me, go somewhere immediately. And we left the same day, and the road was very stressful. And my husband told me, I have to bring you somewhere to the safe place. And I was also pregnant at the time, 4 months. And I didn't want to think about all the danger.
My name is Sonia. I'm 17. The 24th of February 2022 was one of the most horrible days of my life, of course. I remember my mother waking me up at like 7 a.m. saying that the war has begun. The first like hour, I was just shaking and panicking without like any idea what will happen to me, to my family, my friends. Will we even stay alive?
Well, Sonia from Irpin, and before her, Victoria from Kharkiv and Natalie from near Kyiv. Well, despite the international criticism, sanctions and the military setbacks Russia has faced over the last year, Moscow remains defiant. The BBC has been hearing from some Russians and got their views on the conflict in Ukraine.
My expectations? I want this to be over as soon as possible. Of course, we're waiting for Russia to win in the special military operation. The whole world is against us. NATO countries are fighting us through Ukraine, supplying equipment to the Nazis. We're looking forward to winning this year, hopefully. The sooner the better for this to end.
I really want peace. I really want it all to end as soon as possible. Too many victims, morally speaking and materially. We pensioners feel it all.
With more on the Russian perspective, our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports from Moscow.
In Russia, the first anniversary of the war was not headline news.
Провал операции украинских диверсантов.
The bulletins on state TV did give an update on Russia's offensive in Ukraine, but they didn't focus on the anniversary, and they glossed over the fact that President Putin's special military operation had failed to achieve what the Kremlin had expected a year ago, a swift victory. Quite the opposite. Over the last 12 months, the Russian army has suffered heavy losses. A few days ago, a talk show host on state TV admitted that a huge number of people had been killed. There was no end in sight, she said, to the conflict. And what of the man who ordered the invasion? What is Vladimir Putin thinking? What is he planning? Well, from the speeches he's been making, the Kremlin leader seems to think that although the invasion went badly wrong, Russia has the resources and the staying power to ultimately secure victory over Ukraine and over the West. Many Russians still support him and believe the Kremlin's false narrative that Russia is not the aggressor and that the West is out to destroy Russia. And so Mr. Putin is planning to push on and is ready to escalate, if necessary, to achieve his goals. No sign of any Kremlin U-turns. This Russian president isn't for turning.
Steve Rosenberg in Russia. Still to come.
What people have to do on a particular date, it's different for each country, is they have to log in, register on Cathay Pacific's website.
The Great Plane Ticket Giveaway. Why tens of thousands of flights are being handed out free of charge. The authorities in southern Ethiopia say a humanitarian crisis is deepening because of a severe drought there. Officials said that more than 800,000 people required emergency food assistance. Will Ross reports.
Earlier this month, Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed celebrated the fact that the country had started exporting wheat. But in the Oromia region's Borena area, a lack of food is now leading to loss of life. Officials and residents there said 7 people had died in recent days, including a 2-month-old baby. Most families in this part of the country, close to the Kenyan border, earn a living from their livestock, but herds have been hit hard by the most severe drought in 40 years. One farmer said only 4 of his cattle had survived out of 150.
To Kenya now, where the Supreme Court has ruled that it was wrong for the authorities to ban the gay community from registering a rights organisation. But the court stressed that gay sex remained illegal in Kenya. Ferdinand Amondi reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's apex court ruled that the country's NGO board was wrong to stop the registration of the National Gays and Lesbians Human Rights Commission in 2013 or any organisation with the words gay or lesbian in it. The NGO regulator had declined to approve the proposed names on the grounds that Kenya's penal code criminalizes gay and lesbian relationships. But in its judgment, the Supreme Court ruled by a majority that the board violated the group's constitutional rights to freedom of association. It also said it was discriminatory to deny registration purely on the basis of the sexual orientation of the applicants.
Ferdinand Amondi. Now, here's a question for you. What is the point of archaeologists beavering away during building and infrastructure works, trying to unearth and safeguard ancient artefacts, if the public never get to see them on display? Well, Historic England, an organisation which protects old buildings and sites, says that museums are running out of room for such discoveries, ranging from fine Roman metalwork to Bronze Age pottery. Carolyn Quinn spoke to Tristram Hunt, the director of the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and Simon Jenkins, an author and former chair of the conservation charity the National Trust. She first asked Tristram how much is buried away in the V&A basement.
We have 2.8 million objects as part of the V&A's collection. And of displayable objects that can be seen by the public, we have around 300,000, and 60,000 are on display. So we've got 20% of our displayable collection on show. And the reason why it's not all on show is that some of it needs to be rotated for conservation reasons. Some of it needs to be rotated so you have a new conversation between the objects to keep people excited about coming back to the museum. And some of this collection is a study collection. You wouldn't necessarily want to go to a museum and see 50 teaspoons, but great scholars of metalwork or culinary history will want to see those collections for themselves. So collections in museums do lots of different things, and some of it's on display. As much as possible of it should be on display, which is why we're building this new storehouse in East London where the David Bowie archive and other items will be on display. But not all of it should be on display all the time.
Simon Jenkins, is there any point, do you think, in museums and groups like the National Trust holding on to objects that they can't display? Would it just be a good idea to sell them off?
I sympathise with Tristram's collection. I was at the Museum of London for a while, and we every single time an office block was being built, they dug up clay pipes in the basement and sent them to the museum. And we ended up with warehouses and warehouses of this stuff. I think there's an argument for keeping some of it for study and for these precious scholars. But I have to say, by and large, and it applies far more, what I say, to works of art and architecture and furniture than to archaeological remains. By and large, there are massive stores of this stuff in these museums, and they should not be there. They should be on display somewhere else. And they should be, if not forced, at least pleaded with to dispose of them. And when I was at the National Trust, I did plead. The V&A were very helpful, actually. But I pleaded. We got houses half empty, and you've got basements half full. I just couldn't see the point of it. I really couldn't. And they're like magpies. They grab hold of this stuff and they keep it and think of ever more sophisticated reasons for not giving it away or selling it.
Tristram Hunt, it must be really disheartening, though, for, you know, the guys working away on the building sites. You know, they're sent there to check out archaeological finds. They find something and then never know what happens to it after that.
Yeah, I can see their frustration. We are spending more and more money on building more and more of these stores. And I agree with Simon that this stuff needs to be on display to the public because the level of interest in it is really profound. The problem the Victoria and Albert Museum faces, as does the British Museum and some other institutions, is that legally we are not allowed to dispose or deaccession any items from the collection unless they're kind of ruined beyond repair, unless it's a direct imitation or unless another institution will take it. So there is this legal impediment to us deaccessioning, and that connects to these questions around restitution and repatriation, as well as the issue of, are there items in our collection which actually no longer fit with the purpose and meaning of the museum or could be seen better elsewhere? And we work really closely with the National Trust, because lots of our collections do overlap, to have as much of this material on display as possible.
Tristram Hunt and Simon Jenkins there. For well over 2 years, China closed its borders to foreign travellers. Hong Kong was particularly badly hit because it relied so heavily on international tourism. Now, in an attempt to lure back the visitors and their spending power, Hong Kong's airline Cathay Pacific is offering free tickets, tens of thousands of them, in fact. Our Asia Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow, told me more about the plan.
Cathay Pacific announced today that they're giving away 80,000 return airfares to people who live in nearby countries, Southeast Asian countries. So we're talking Cambodia, Vietnam, the Philippines, Singapore, that kind of thing. What people have to do on a particular date, and it's different for each country, is they have to log in, register on Cathay Pacific's website, and then quickly answer three questions. And it's the first few thousand who are going to get the free tickets. And this is just one part of a bigger scheme funded by the Hong Kong government in which they're giving away 500,000 return airfares to Hong Kong, costing about $250 million, so a lot of money. The aim is to basically encourage people to come back to Hong Kong to restart the tourism industry, because it's a massive part of the Hong Kong economy, but it suffered terribly under COVID because people couldn't go there because they had really tight restrictions.
How much does Hong Kong rely on tourism?
Well, I'll just tell you the numbers and it'll give you an indication. Before the pandemic, there were about 56 million people visited Hong Kong every year, an extraordinary amount of people when you think it's only a small place with 7 million people itself. It went down to just a trickle during the pandemic. So you can imagine all the hotels, all the restaurants that were geared up to take in tourists in suddenly had no work. And so the government there is desperate to try and get people to come back. And obviously they think it's worth spending all this money getting people to Hong Kong for nothing, so that when they get there, they're going to spend a lot of money on hotels and sightseeing and food and all that kind of thing.
It's quite hard, isn't it, to actually revive something that's pretty much dead?
It is. And this is a pattern that's repeated across Southeast Asia and across many countries across the world which are coming out of COVID and lockdown restrictions. I mean, Thailand, for example, so desperate are they for Chinese tourists that when the first group arrived in January from China, three government ministers turned up to welcome them. Countries across Southeast Asia are desperately looking for ways in order to get people travelling again. And this is one of those ways. And people are desperate as well to make those trips because lots of people have been suffering from lockdowns and want to go on holiday again. And just on Thursday, Qantas, for example, the airline from Australia, announced record profits because people are desperately trying to get onto planes again to travel again. So I think the Hong Kong government is pushing an open door here.
Michael Bristow. An elephant never forgets, so the saying goes. But how do you go about testing an elephant's powers of recall in practice? Well, one scientist from Germany found an ingenious way of doing it by seeing how elephants react to smelling their relatives' dung. I spoke to the co-author of the study, Franziska Hörner, from the University of Wuppertal.
I went around the whole of Germany with a lot of elephant poo and I presented it to different elephants. So I had three different samples for each of the elephants. I had a sample of an elephant that they were totally familiar with, a member of their herd, for example. And then I had a sample of a stranger, so an elephant that they had never, ever met and didn't know at all. And then I always had a sample of a relative that they was living separate from. So it was either the sample of a mother or a daughter. We had the idea that they would probably react more intense to the sample of the separate living relative. And it turned out they actually did.
So how did they react?
With the important samples of the relatives, they showed a wide branch of behavior. So they collared, which is a sound they can express, which is very intense, I would say. And they paced backwards. They started flapping the ears and lifting the head, tail, trunk. They also started defecating, and some of them even started running around the whole enclosure. And the signs that we saw all taken in one showed that it was excitement and mostly positive excitement.
So to what extent did this fit with what you were expecting to find?
Elephants are known for their long-term memory, right? But there's just no real proof for this. We expected them to react in a certain way, but I have to admit, I myself was really surprised how intense the reaction in the end was.
Do we know how long it had been since they'd seen their relatives?
So we had two mother-daughter pairs, and one of them hadn't seen each other in 2 years, and the other in 12 years. So quite a long time.
12 years, and yet this reaction was pretty extreme.
They showed us that they still remember the scent and that they don't forget their relatives, which is known for them also in the wild. They never forget the family bonds they have. But I often ask myself the question, would I remember the scent of my mother or my sister after 12 years not smelling her? I'm not sure about it. I hope so. But we know that the elephants do.
That was Francesca Herner. Now, as I'm recording this podcast, I'm wearing a blue cotton shirt and some chinos. But according to new data, I could soon be here in a hoodie and jeans or even a pair of leather trousers, let's say. Yes, new analysis of more than a million job adverts posted in the UK this month has found that almost 80% of those citing a dress code use the word casual. And employers are prioritising comfort and a relaxed attitude to personal styling. A stylish Stephanie Prentice has more.
As offices worldwide locked down during the COVID-19 pandemic, workers forced to interact remotely over video soon went from wearing shirts and ties to hoodies, leisure wear and even pyjamas. Now with offices back open, a more casual dress culture seems to be here to stay, with many job adverts dropping words like business casual and smart casual, opting instead for just casual. Aisha Vardag is a divorce lawyer who runs her own firm. Pre-pandemic, she encouraged double-cuff shirts with cufflinks and even banned staff from wearing cardigans in the office. Now she's told her employees they can dress in sequins, scarlet Doc Martens or even have pink hair as part of a new move towards self-expression over formality.
I have said, express yourself, bring your personality to work. If you want to wear gold leather trousers and an electric blue sequin jacket, that is absolutely fine by me.
Suits, shirts and high heels are among the items that the new study says office workers want to move on from. Theo van den Broeke is editorial director at the group of Soho House members clubs and writes for men's fashion magazine GQ.
I think the suit has transformed into something that perhaps should be worn in occasions that demand something smarter. The idea of a dress code, I think, was originally created to make people feel as comfortable in environments as it was to make them look appropriate. And I think now that we're working in this kind of hybrid way, we should be dressing in a hybrid way. And a suit is a very kind of monolithic thing.
So how to proceed for anyone out there wondering how to get the balance right? Experts say that guidance and clarity from employers is important. And according to Theo van den Broeke, setting personal style boundaries.
I, for instance, will not wear tracksuit bottoms into the office. That's a strict no. Jersey, no. Knitwear, however, yes. So I think there are lenient parameters within it.
Parameters that are seemingly becoming more lenient by the day, though the BBC at least may not have entered its leather trouser era just yet.
Not quite yet. That was Steph Prentice. And that is all from us for now. But before we go, here's a word from my colleague, Andrew Peach.
Yes, you know we love hearing from you on the Global News podcast, and I wonder if you can help us out with something new. We'd like to hear about the sound you really love. Could be a piece of music. Could be a sound from the natural environment in your part of the world. The sound of children in your family enjoying themselves. Or maybe something really simple like the sound of making a cup of coffee. Drop us an email to tell us about the sound and why it makes you happy. globalnews@bbc.co.uk. And if you can record it on your phone and send it to us as a voice note, even better. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. We can't wait to hear it.
Thanks very much, Andrew. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email at the same address. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Matt Dean. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles. And until next time, goodbye.